The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is a very interesting question, what we're going to deal with today. We mentioned yesterday, you know, in our discussion of patterns in time, we spoke about sort of more of an introduction and a discussion about Passover. Now we're going to get into a little bit more of the meat of Pesach and why Pesach sets the stage for all the festivals. Then this afternoon, we're going to get into the Omer and Shavuot, and that's really a cycle from Pesach to Shavuot. So Pesach is a beginning, but it's definitely not the goal. And I think it's, by the way, very interesting that we're having this class on July 4th, okay? Because I forgot it was July 4th, but I took a ride with somebody this morning. He said, you know, we're having a big barbecue. I said, oh, that's nice. He said, oh, yeah, we do one every year. I said, really, what's the occasion? He looked at me like I was an idiot. And kind of reminded me, I was once driving through Bethlehem. You know, in the old days, the road from Gush Etzion went through Bethlehem, and there were all these lights up, you know. And one of my kids said, what are all these lights? And I said, oh, you know, that's for Christmas. And my daughter was about 7 at the time. She said, what's Christmas? And I said, yes. You know? I saw actually a sign. There's a sign up somewhere along Misgav Adach Street. It's a poster, and they change it every day. It says 100 days till Rosh Hashanah. Love that, right? I love that. If somebody has to make a calendar, you know, you'll send a percentage to Israelite when it works. But anyway, so it's fitting because July 4th really is, in America, it's a celebration of independence, right? Freedom, right? They call it Independence Day, but they're really celebrating freedom. And I remember when this really hit me. When I was a kid, America celebrated its bicentennial, right? 1976. Some of you may remember this. Some of you don't. Don't tell us. We don't want to know. But in July 4th, 1976, so America went nuts. They had this thing called Operation Sail, if you remember. The U.S. Navy sent aircraft carriers and battleships up the Hudson River. I grew up in an apartment in the city that happened to have a view of the Hudson River. So all our friends and neighbors came up to our apartment, and we watched this from the window. And tens of thousands of people streamed into Riverside Park to watch this. And then at night, they had this big fireworks celebration. One night was in Battery Park, and the next night was in Central Park. And they had a free concert. I think it was Elton John. They had a free concert in the park, and they announced on the radio that the first 100,000 people that came to the concert were going to get a free beer. Okay? So my brother and I, you know, I was in high school at the time. My brother and I, we got on our bikes. We figured we'd ride over and check it out, right? Now, normally, back then anyway, you didn't ride on your bike with a keep on into Central Park at midnight. But this was like party time. Like, you know, the whole world was there. And we ride into Central Park, and just as we're getting into Central Park, okay, I mean, you have to imagine this, right? A million New Yorkers, 100,000 of whom have just gotten free beer, okay, right, in Central Park, you know? And this guy comes running across the park, right, the pony trail in Central Park, completely stark naked except for a pair of sneakers, right, sees us on our bikes, holds up two beers and goes, "Be free, baby!" Right? And that's some people's perception of freedom, you know. Be free, baby, right? Judaism has a very different way of looking at freedom, right? How do we celebrate freedom, right? What is the apex of our celebration of freedom? It's called the Seder, right? The night of the Seder. Now, the night of the Seder is a rather strange way to celebrate freedom. It is the most structured night of the year. In fact, the word Seder means order, okay? That's how we celebrate freedom. And if you look at the rituals in the celebration of Pesach, of Passover, they're very structured. You have to have 4 cups of wine, you can't have 3, and you can't have 5. Well, you could have 5 if you follow certain customs, but you definitely can't have 6. And how much wine should you have? Well, you have to have at least 4.4 fluid ounces. And how much matzah do you eat? Well, you eat 3 matzahs, you eat 2 matzahs, you have to eat a kazayik, which is a certain amount, and make sure you eat just the amount and don't forget to leave. There's so many rituals, you know? And I always have like a little bit of mercy on people who come to the Seder who are newbies, who've never had a Seder before, because they don't know what they're in for. Right? You really set them up. You know, you sit them down, they can smell all that food coming out of the kitchen, they're all excited, you know? You sing this little song, the Kadesh Orchatz, right? And then, you know, everybody's happy and all the dishes are on the table and there's like vegetables. And then you have a whole cup of wine. And at my seder, I tell everybody, you know, we drink wine to feel free. So drink up, you know, we drink the whole cup. By the end of the first cup, you're already feeling free. And then you give them a little hors d'oeuvre and they're getting all excited. They're getting all excited because they can smell that duck roasting in the kitchen, right? And then you just start to read. And to read, and to read. And Nebuch, you know? Where's the freedom? Right? What is that all about? What is... I mean, there's a fundamental difference between the way we celebrate freedom and the way the world celebrates freedom. Because in Judaism, the question is freedom for what? What's all the freedom for? Freedom has no value unless you know what to do with it. In fact, freedom without a purpose can actually be chaos. So that's sort of in the background of what we're going to study this morning. Okay? Now, if Pesach, as we mentioned yesterday, Passover, is really the beginning of this whole tapestry that we call patterns in time, different festivals, then it's interesting that the name of this festival really sets the theme. Now, understand why I'm saying this. There is a general perception, okay, that beginnings set the tone. How you start something is very, very important. There's a power to beginnings. In fact, it's interesting. If we were studying, you know, biblical ethics or Torah or whatever, so if I asked you, what was the first thing that God created, what would you say? First thing that God created. First thing Hashem created. Pardon? Et. Nope. That's interesting. No, bara et, and God created. Nope. What's the first thing? Pardon? No. I understand the idea. I understand that there's a whole ma'amar and sefer otiot. But think about it. What is the first thing that Hashem created? Space. That's what I would have thought. Space, right? God created heavens and earth. But it's not entirely true. It's a very interesting idea. You see, if you think about it, if Hashem is, you know, it's kind of hard to talk about God, talk about Hashem. That's why I work with Rabbi Aaron. I leave that to him. But it's kind of hard to talk about something that you can't define. How do you define the indefinable? And, you know, if we were to go around this room and ask everybody what they thought God is, we'd probably get about 40 different explanations or perceptions. So it's very hard to have this discussion. But however you look at whatever Hashem is, Hashem certainly seems to be endless. Hashem always was, Hashem always will be. Which means that before God creates the world, there's no such thing as a beginning. The first thing Hashem has to create is the concept of a beginning, because there never was a beginning. There's no need for a beginning. Hashem was Hashem, just always was. This is, by the way, a very difficult concept for us to get our hands around. I remember once, I was having a discussion with a fellow who defined himself as an atheist. And we were getting into discussion about sort of atheism and belief. And I'm really not, you know, I don't go out hunting atheists on a crusade for save the whales, save the atheists. That's not really my, scene. But we're getting into this as a discussion. I don't actually personally, in fact, it's one of the things I love about Israelite. I'm not really into convincing anybody of anything. I don't really think there's much value to it. You know, it's like, I don't know, like I could introduce you to a nice girl, right? Let's say I have, met a nice girl. I say, Baruch, met a nice girl. It's actually not my thing. I usually set up the Amazon and the pygmy. That's another problem I have, but whatever. But let's say I introduce you to a nice girl. So I could tell you about the girl. I could share with you how wonderful she is. After that, you know, it's up to you, right? If I have to convince you to marry her, then something's wrong. So that's how I look at life in general and Judaism in particular. I'm willing to share with you what I find beautiful about Judaism, but what you do with that is up to you, right? So that's not my speed. So, but this guy really wants to be convinced. So we're getting into discussion, and he finally says to me, you know what my biggest problem is? So my biggest problem is, what came before God? So I said, what do you mean, what came before God? Well, where did God come from? What came before God? So I said, well, you know, my understanding is that God is eternal. Hashem just always was. What do you mean always was? What came before that? I said, well, there was no before that. Right? So I said, okay, well, how do you look at the beginning of existence? He says, well, you know, there was a Big Bang theory. So I said, okay, Big Bang happens to make a lot of sense to me. I mean, if you look at the Torah, right? First day it says, Vayom Elokim Yehi Or, God says, let there be light, right? And the sun doesn't get created until the fourth day. So of course, if the sun is only created on the fourth day, what's the light of the first day? By the way, if the sun is only created on the fourth day, what's a day on the first day? Right? Our understanding of a day is that it's the relationship between the earth and the sun. If there's no sun, there's no day. So all we know about the day is that the days are some kind of measurements of time, okay? By the way, this is a tangent of a tangent of a tangent now, but just so we're all on the same page here, what is time? I had a Rebbe used to say, if you can't explain something in a simple sentence, it's because you don't really understand it. I can explain things in simple sentences and still don't understand something. That's a special gift I have, but But time is really, if you think about it, time is really the measurement of movement. Right? You know, you have a second hand, it's measuring seconds, which is a percentage of a minute, which is a percentage of an hour, which is a percentage of a day. A day is the measurement of the revolutions of the earth. A year is a measurement of the orbit of the earth. Light years, right? Time is really a measurement of physical movement. So if Hashem created physical movement, before there was physical movement, there was no time. So God created time. That's how we can say that God is above time. Which doesn't mean I know what that means either, but that's why we can say it, right? So before there's a sun, there's no such concept as a day. All I know about days is that they're measurements of time, and I really have no idea how long that time measurement for any particular day was. And to be honest, it doesn't really interest me. That's really not the Torah's interest. That's science's interest, but it's not the Torah's interest. There are six units of time that we call days at the beginning of creation. They could be 1,000 years, they could be 1,000,000 years, they could be 1,000,000,000 years. You know, Kabbalah has all what to say on this topic, but whatever it might be. So that's why the whole question of, you know, how old is the earth and how does that relate to creation doesn't really faze me. I never understood why people get so upset about that, because it's not really the interest of the Torah. And by the way, it's also important to mention that science, now we're dealing with the realm of opinion, science does not really negate the Torah. Science is just an enormous tool to understand the Torah. So going back to where we started, if light is created on the first day and the sun is only created on the fourth day, well then, what's light? How could you have light without the sun? I mean, what would that light be? What's the nature of that light? Very hard to understand what that could be if there's no sun. So what is light? Light is energy. So if there was a big bang and there's this enormous release of energy, that could be Vayom Elokim Yehi Or. It wouldn't bother me in the least. Right? So I asked him, okay, so where did that energy come from, this atheist fellow? So he said, well, you know, energy is neither created nor destroyed. It just always was. So I said, but okay, but what came before the energy? So he said, well, there was no before the energy always was. So what do you mean there was energy always was? What came before the energy? He said, well, there was no before the energy. Ding. So all he's done is substitute God for energy, and that depends on your perspective on life. But that's not really the beginning. The beginning is not energy or light or matter or space or time. The beginning is the concept of a beginning. Hashem has to create the concept of a beginning. And that may be why beginnings are so powerful. How you begin something is enormous. It's enormous. It's not accidental, by the way, this is just the realm of opinion again, that the current intifada began on Rosh Hashanah. Because it was heralding in a whole different era almost. So we have to pay attention to beginnings. So Pesach is a beginning. And every time you have a portion of the week, for example, pay very close attention to how the portion begins and how it ends, because those are bookends. And the beginning of a portion sets the theme for the portion. I'll give you a great example. This is a very exciting week, because this week, the diaspora catches up with Israel. Okay? You've been a portion behind, you, I say you. We're a mixed group here. But those people who came from overseas, so you missed a portion. You missed a parsha. It's an interesting challenge. If you lose sleep over it, you're on a very high level. But you know, on Shavuot, which was the festival we're going to get to this afternoon, it was a two-day festival overseas. It's a one-day festival in Israel. The second day of the festival is Shabbat. So in America, let's say, they were reading on the second day of Shavuot, the Torah reading for Shavuot. In Israel, we were already reading the portion of the week, because it was a regular Shabbat. So you got sort of a week behind us. So this past Shabbat, right, in America, they read Korach. And in Israel, they read Chukat. And this coming Shabbat, we're going to read Balak. And in America, they're going to read Chukat Balak. Okay, so we're all going to catch up. So that means that Chukat is actually not the portion of the week anymore, but it still is the portion of the week. I guess it depends how sensitive you are to overseas. So what is Chukat? The beginning of Chukat of this portion is Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the law of the Torah, and a chok is a type of law which supposedly, this is a difficult topic, supposedly is impossible for us to fathom. It's beyond our comprehension. Now that's a very difficult topic, because then all the commentaries go ahead and try to explain it anyway, because that's what Jews do. But that's an interesting discussion over lunch if you want. But this is the chukah. So that means that this portion, the theme of this portion, is that which I cannot fully ever understand. Guess what, when you look through the portion of chukat, guess what chukat talks about? The major underlying theme of that whole portion is death. This is the portion in which Aaron dies. This is the portion in which Miriam dies. This is the portion in which we deal with how to purify people after they come into contact with death. It's all about death. It's the theme. So that means that the theme of the festivals, the beginning of the festivals, is Pesach. And the word which we use to name this festival is the word Pesach. P Passover. Now, why do we call this festival Passover? So I don't want you to answer that question, because I want to do a little experiment, okay? Because the truth is that right now, we're learning together, but we're not really learning together, okay? I'm talking, and you're listening. And that's nice, you know, but I wanted to see if we could maybe do a little learning, okay? So just out of curiosity, what would you say, and anybody who's ever learned with me, you know, you figured this out already, but what would you say is the most important aspect of learning? You have to pick what the most important aspect of learning is. If you're going to learn something, what is the most important aspect of learning if you had to choose? Yes?
The question.
Pardon? The question. Okay? The questions are, people talk about comprehension, they talk about understanding, they talk about reading. That's all important. But absolutely the most important of learning is the question. If you have a good question, you'll come back to it. If you don't have a good question, you haven't really learned it. By the way, that's not just true for Torah, that's true for life. Right? The girl I was going to introduce you to, right? If you meet that girl, and you go on a date, and you walk away and you feel you have all the answers, you're not going out with her again. But if you walk away with like a question, there's something that intrigues you, you'll go out with her again. Because we pursue the question, right? So here's what I want to do. I want us to take like 10, 15 minutes, and I want to learn something. Okay? Now the ideal way to learn is not to learn on your own. There are different types of learning. There's learning from a teacher, which isn't really learning from, but that's a whole other discussion. There's learning. One of the epitomes of learning is what we call chavruta. Right? The longest standing yeshiva in the world until 1948 was in southern Iraq, okay? It was in a place called Sura. This was a yeshiva academy that opened up in the beginning of the 4th century. And it ran uninterruptedly. It was actually one of the places where the Talmud was written and edited. It was an uninterrupted flow of Torah for almost 1,800 years until 1700 years, until 1948 when it finally got closed by Iraq. Now, if you would have walked into that yeshiva in any time over those 1,700 years, you would have seen the same thing. You would have seen pairs of guys sitting around the table struggling with something. Okay? And I'll give you just as an example. I remember when I first came to Israel, when I came to yeshiva. So I had grown up in a traditional world. I went to yeshiva day school. I went to yeshiva high school. But, you know, you're like in class, right? Now, I wanted to come to Israel to see what it would be like to learn without anybody telling me to learn. Just to see if I could really fall in love with learning. So I heard about this place, and I went there. I didn't know much about it. It was called Gush. And I came in May towards the end of the year because I got early graduation, whatever. And I show up to this yeshiva, and it wasn't like I was with the whole group that was coming at the beginning of the year. I was coming like after Pesach. And I remember this vividly. I walk into the Beis Medrash, and the first thing I see, and it's a huge Beis Medrash, but you come up the stairs and you see the first row. And I see these two guys, okay? And one guy is sitting in a chair, like at a table like this. In fact, he's got this, his kippah's like this, okay? So I'm thinking maybe this is a yeshiva thing, right? He's got his kippah's like this, right? And the other guy is standing on top of him, and they've got like a couple of Talmuds, a couple of Gemaras open, right? And the one who's standing up, okay, he's going nuts, right? And he's yelling at this fellow who's sitting, okay? And it takes me a second to catch what he's yelling. He looks and goes, so what are you talking about? What are you talking about? That's not what Rashi says. You're crazy. That's not it. Look at the dozos. And the guy who's sitting down, he's looking up at this guy. He says, what's the matter with you? Look at the dozos. It can't be what it is. Listen to you. Go see the Rambam, right? So I think like, okay, you know, there's something off. Maybe that's why they're in the back. So I walk up a couple more steps, and I see there's another couple of guys, and they're doing the same thing. Only these two guys, they're standing up. They're like ready to punch each other out. You know, listen, the Degel Machne Ephraim doesn't say that. There's no way he says that. It's clear that the rugged shepherd doesn't understand it that way. You don't know what you're talking about. And I start looking around the room, and there's like 300 guys. They're all over this range, and they're all arguing with each other. And I feel like I've walked into Dante's Inferno. I have no idea what's going on. And then the most amazing thing, there was a guy there, balding head with a beard. I didn't know then that he was Rav Midan. He would become my Rebbe. And he's doing this. He's walking. He has his eyes closed, mind you. He's got this, I don't know how he does it. He puts his arm around his back. And he grabs this arm, right? And he can still move this arm. I don't know how he does that. We call him stretch. But anyway, and he's like walking back and forth like this, stroking his beard, right? And he's arguing, but he's arguing with himself. What are you talking about? That can't be right. No, that can't. Of course it's right. No, it can't be right. Because look at the Rambam. The Rambam doesn't say, no, I can't be right. Right? And I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, they're all nuts. But I want you to understand, they are so immersed in their learning, right? It bothers them so much, they're struggling with it so much, that it looks like they're arguing. That is the true challenge of learning, to become invested. So here's what I want you to do, okay? We're going to give out boxing gloves. No. I'm going to give you out a piece of text, okay? This piece of text, okay, may be familiar to some of you. It's actually the source of a very important mitzvah that we're also going to get to talk about. And it is the basis on which we call the festival of Pesach, Pesach. And it should raise some interesting questions. Now what I want you to do, okay, is pick at least a partner. It doesn't matter to me if you pick the person sitting next to you, or you pick someone else, okay, or however it works out. Take this text, and what I want you to do, the first stage of learning is just to read. Just read it through. You're not learning yet. You're reading it to see what's there. Then, with a friend, I want you to rip it apart. Okay? Feel free to get up from your seat, turn around your chair so you can face each other like they do in yeshiva, or however you do it. I don't mind if you're a pair or a threesome, but you should not do this on your own. Let's take 10 minutes, go through this text, see what bothers you. When we come back together, then we'll find out what bothered you. Okay? Take it away. If you find that you're still in the middle of a thought, and it's like you wish you had another 5 minutes, then that's good, because that's how learning should be. Okay? So this is a strange little portion over here. So let me hear. Well, what bothers you about this? Well, what are the questions? Let me hear. From the beginning of the portion to the end, let me hear. Yes. Pardon? No, go ahead. Okay.
Where'd they get all the lambs?
Ooh. Okay, that's a very good question. Right there, like slaves. There's 600,000 men in Egypt. Okay? 600,000 men in Egypt. That's what the verse says. Alright? By the way, that's an interesting point because, you know, the Torah talks about that there's a section that we say in the Shemona Esrei, in the 18 benedictions, the 18 now 19 blessings, right? Those of you who know it, it's the center core of tefillah of our what we mistakenly call prayer, tefillah, davening, and one of them is called modim, modim anachnu lach. Modim doesn't mean I thank you; it means we are in a state of thankfulness. And one of the lines in there is Va'al nisecha v'niflotecha shebechol yom imanu. We thank Hashem for the miracles that are with us every day. There are different types of miracles. There are miracles you can see, you know, and there are miracles you can't see. And at the end of the day, if God runs the world, it's no big deal if there are miracles. Of course there are miracles. God runs the world. And of course if God runs the world, then miracles are only natural. And of course if miracles are only natural, all of nature is miraculous. So how you define a miracle is a very difficult question. But sometimes there are miracles that are so out of the ordinary that we can see them. Right? Or that they stare us in the face. I don't know. It could be the splitting of the sea. It could be the 6-day war. It could be the birth of a child. If you stand in the room, and 1 minute there's 2 of you, and the next minute there's 3 of you, that's just unbelievable. Right? And then there are miracles you don't see. Like the fact that your knees are working. So this is one of the Mefarshim, the Malbim actually, Leibush Malbim talks about this, that there are miracles that are there, you just don't know how to look for them. You know, if you think about the fact that 200 years earlier there are 70 individuals, the Torah tells me there are 70 individuals, okay, and now there's 600,000 men over 200 years, you heard my little numbers game yesterday, that's just unbelievable. That's just unbelievable, right? So either it's a miracle, or somebody got the numbers wrong, which I would have a hard time with, you can imagine, right? And this is another example of a miracle. Like, in order for 600,000 men... Now, by the way, Josephus was a historian. The verdict is not out on him yet. He was actually a rebel general. Fought against the Romans in the Great Revolt in the year 67. He fought in the Galil, in the north, alongside Yochanan Gush Chalav, Elazar ben Yair of Masada fame. He did something that they just didn't do. He figured it out. He just got it. He figured out this was not going to work. The jig was up. The Roman army was too great. The rabbis, by the way, agreed with him. They felt that we weren't worthy of victory, that the temple was destroyed not because of Roman strategy, but because of the way we treated each other. So he switched sides. And he actually joined the Romans. Okay? He became an advisor on military affairs to the Romans. Now the reason I say the verdict isn't out on him yet was because on the one hand, the fact that he switched sides and surrendered some of his men with him saved lives. I mean, those Jews in the end who surrendered were not killed, and it could be that we're all descended from those Jews, so it's hard for us to know what we would do in his place. But he did join the Romans. He even took a Roman name, the royal name Flavius, right? And he became, you know, a minister of affairs. What was most important for our perception is that he kept an accounting of what he saw. Now that's very unique because we were an oral people. We didn't like to write things down. This is before the Mishnah was written down. So to write things down, that was very rare. Right? We got a written Torah. We didn't write things down. We passed it on orally. He wrote things down. So we have an eyewitness accounting of the entire story of the Great Revolt and the destruction of the temple. And when we go to Masada, by the way, I'll give you some idea of why we think that this is an accurate historical revolt. Just unbelievable the things that he wrote there. But he actually has a discussion about this question. Right? I forget whether it was Antoninus or whether it was Vespasian, wanted to know how many Jews were going up on the Temple Mount to offer the sacrifices. And they also wanted to take a census, so he did a very clever thing. He counted the entrails. Okay, the Jews would take the entrails out of the sacrifices, they would throw them in a pile, and he had Romans who were counting. Their job was to count the entrails. And he figures there that approximately for one lamb, how many people do you think it took to consume one lamb? Nope. That's what I would have thought. 50 people. Yeah, a lamb is a big gazenta deal. I'm like you, I grew up in a city. A lamb comes in the supermarket as chops, you know? I figure that's what, you know, they grow there, right? But no, that's what he writes. He writes that, you know, for every lamb you can assume 50 individuals. I guess that's families with little kids. I'm sure they had little lamb portions, whatever. But, and he comes up with just unbelievable numbers. Like if you count his numbers and multiply, you're talking about a couple million people that went up on the Temple Mount on the eve of Passover to offer up the Paschal lamb. Okay? And that's in Josephus, right? I think it was 400,000. I forget the number that he gives. Now you go up on the rooftop here and you look at the Temple Mount. How do 2 million people fit up there? You know what? Never mind 2 million people. Let's assume there's one person bringing each lamb. How do 250,000? That's unbelievable. So there are hidden miracles all the time. And we don't know what to do. Good question. What else? What else? Yes?
Don't kill a lamb. They kill a Passover.
The Shachatu HaPasach, right? They slaughter. It's already called the Paschal lamb, the Pesach. No. This is the word Pesach.
Yeah, Pesach.
So ask the question.
It's Passover. Maybe it has nothing to do with a lamb.
Well, no. How is it called Pesach if Pesach hasn't happened?
No, that's right.
This is before God passes over. Why is it called Pesach?
And it's also...
Right? Good question. What else? Give me another question. Any other questions?
Needed the sign on the door.
Did you ever think about this? This is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. God says, let's talk about this for a minute, okay? They're going to take a lamb, and they're going to slaughter the lamb. Okay, that I can understand. They shech the lamb. Lamb chops. Okay. They shech the lamb. Now what you got to do is you got to take the blood of the lamb. What do you do with the blood of the lamb? You paint it over your doorpost, okay? Hang on 1 second. Pardon? Right, the Ezov, and that's something we've lost in our day. All right, we'll get to that. Right? So they paint the door jamb with lamb. With lamb's blood. Okay? And why are they doing this? First of all, this is a very bizarre thing. I mean, imagine that you have the Medrash, the rabbinic tradition, has this as not just being lamb's blood. Okay, this lamb was taken and set aside on the 10th day of the month of Nisan, which in the year of the Exodus was Shabbat, and that's why to this day, the Shabbat before Passover is called Shabbat HaGadol, the Great Shabbat. We're going to have to figure why that this is such a great Shabbat. One's so great for the lambs, but okay, right? So they take the lamb, and they have to tie it up in front of their house, right? Now, they don't actually slaughter the lamb until the 14th of Nisan. So what's going on for those 3 days? I mean, like, where I come from, you want to have a barbecue, you get your meat fresh, right? You know, you don't keep it for a week. So, why is it there for 4 days? So the rabbi said, oh, that's simple. Because the men had to get circumcised. Now, there is a tradition that you're not allowed to be circumcised. This is a halacha. That you're not allowed to be circumcised. You don't circumcise a child if you're not sure if the child is going to have to journey. In fact, this was a major question that occurred in the Holocaust. There's a great rabbi, we'll get to him in a minute, there's a great rabbi, his name was Rav Ephraim Ashri, and he was one of the last rabbis of the ghetto of Kovno. And he was made a watchman. You know, the Nazis couldn't handle the fact that they had this rabbiner at the beginning when they moved into Lithuania. They weren't yet open about their plans, so they were still pretending that if you worked, you know, that was good, and if you had a job, and it made you free, and all this sort of stuff. So they were giving out work permits, and work papers, and labor battalions. So at the beginning, they didn't want to take the older people, because it would be a little too transparent. But the thought that an older rabbiner was walking out, a rabbi was walking around, he didn't have a job, that bothered him. So they found him a job. They got him this ridiculous Keystone Cop outfit. They put on this Keystone Cop-like thing, and they stuck him in front of a warehouse, and he had to stand there. Anybody see the Brady Bunch? You know, halt, who goes there, right? You know? So he had to stand, never mind. He had to stand in front of the warehouse and guard this thing. So one day he gets curious. Who are all these high-ranking officials who are coming in and out of this warehouse all day? So he takes a peek inside. And he discovered that the warehouse on the outskirts of Kovno was a repository for the treasures of the Jewish people that were being stored for the eventual museum of the extinct Jewish people that the Nazis were going to open up in Berlin after the war. Now this is known. There's actually an exhibit about this in Yad Vashem. They were going to open up a museum. Now what did the Nazis collect? They didn't keep Jewish artwork. You know where that went, right? So what did they collect? They collected Jewish books. And the Nazis were meticulous. They were catalogers, right? So basically what they had done is they took a huge Torah scholar, Talmud Chacham, and they gave him a library. So people heard that this tremendous Rav had access to Sfarim, to books. They started bringing him their questions. And the questions that they ask are unbelievable. And he actually kept an accounting of these questions. He didn't have the ability to answer them as he would have before the war. You know, he just slipped in for a minute if he had a chance. But he answered their questions, and he wrote down on scripts of paper what the questions were and what he had answered, because he figured, you know, when things were calmer, he'd be able one day to look up and see if he'd given the right answers, and he asked people's names, who had asked him the question in case he had to get back to them. And he took these scripts and he hid them in cans and he buried them. He survived the war. And after the war, he came back to Kovno and he dug up these cans and he published this as a series of volumes called Mima Makim, From the Depths. Unbelievable volumes. And there's actually a one-volume annotated, edited version of this in English. It's called The Holocaust and Halacha. It's actually somewhere there on the shelf. You can look at it. It's just unbelievable. It's an incredible book. I used to read this every year on Tisha B'Av. Just an incredible book to see what the questions are. Never mind the answers, what the questions are. Can you make a Seder on 4 cups of water? You know? Should you make a blessing if you're forced to eat pig on Yom Kippur? You know? What do you do if you become pregnant and the Nazis put a death sentence on anybody who is pregnant? Are you allowed to have an abortion? And all such questions. And you just, it's just hard to imagine how we struggled with this question, right? And he actually asked an interesting question in terms of the topic of mezuzah, in terms of whether or not doors in the ghetto were required to have mezuzah. We're going to get to that, right? But one of his questions was, are you allowed, you know, there's a fellow with a baby and he wants to circumcise his son, and they were in the Kovno ghetto. And he actually ruled halakhically that people shouldn't be circumcising their children because you didn't know if the child was going to be able to stay in one place for 3 days, which is what halakha, Jewish tradition, requires, out of safety concern for the child. And since you don't know that, you don't know if they're going to make you move, therefore you'd be putting the life in danger, and therefore, for years over the Holocaust, there were whole communities of Jews that did not have circumcisions. And there were massive circumcisions after the Holocaust. Put aside for the moment, you know, what that means. And that people still wanted to circumcise their children after the Holocaust. That's just mind-boggling. So that was the state of affairs in Egypt. They were slaves. You're a slave. You don't own your space and you don't own your time. You don't know. So they weren't able to circumcise themselves. So the Medrash says, Jewish legend says, the reason they had 3 days was before they were going to go into the desert and again have the journey, they would take 3 days to circumcise themselves. So the Medrash goes a step further. Quoting a verse in Yechezkel, and I say to you, by your bloods do you live, right? So the commentaries say, what does it mean there when Ezekiel the prophet, much, much later in time, says that the Jewish people sustain themselves by their bloods instead of by their blood? The blood of the Paschal lamb and the blood of circumcision. And therefore the rabbis say, they didn't just take, you know, the blood of the Paschal lamb. They mixed it with the blood of circumcision. And that's how they painted their door. Now, imagine you have a new friend. And he doesn't know much about Judaism. And, you know, you're really getting into this Jew thing, right? And you know that you're going to have a big Seder, you know, because you're getting out of Egypt. You say, well, why don't you come along? You know, there were assimilated Jews in Egypt. So you bring him along, you know, you're all excited to show him what a Jewish home is like. And your dad is up there and he's painting the door. And you say, Dad, what are you painting the door? That's a funny looking paint. He goes, oh, this is circumcision blood mixed with Paschal lamb blood. Out of here! What is this? This is such a strange thing. What is this? And by the way, what major mitzvah comes from this section? Mezuzah. This is the beginning of the basis for the mezuzah, okay, that we walk by in our door. To remember blood on the doorpost. What is that for? So as Nuzza points out, why do we need blood on the door? Right? Well, because when God was going to come, and visit the 10th plague, okay, the 10th plague was the most serious of all the plagues. This is the first one where people are actually dying, at least according to one opinion, right? Makat Bechorot, the firstborn. God says, Va'ani avo b'tuvi. God himself somehow is going to bring this plague. So in order that God should know who the Jews are, we should paint the doorpost with blood. You ever think about that? I got this image of God in this big sleigh with reindeer, and he's got a white beard, ho, 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 and he's kind of rolling through Cairo, you know? And he's just making sure he's not taking any Jewish names, you know? Goldberg, no problem. Schwartz, no problem. Christopoulos, I don't know. Blood, no problem. That's ridiculous! Like, what is this? And by the way, understand, this is the essence of this festival. Because this is the name that we give to this festival. We call it Pesach. Ki Pesach al Batei Mitzrayim. Hashem passed over. Even in English we call it Passover. That's such a strange name for a holiday. Why don't you call it Freedom? Chag HaChirut. We have other names for it. Chag HaAviv, the festival of springtime, of rebirth, of new... Passover. Chag HaMatzot. The festival of Matzot. What is the festival Pesach? And you know, it's interesting. The Prit Tzaddik, the Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, has a whole article. It was Prit Tzaddik. I think it's in Prit Tzaddik. He says that that you have to pay very close attention to what the Jewish people do. Because the Jewish people have an inner sense. And whenever the Jewish people decides to do something, it comes from a mystical sense. There's a power to that. There's a reason for that. You know, for example, this. This thing we call kippah. Do you know that halachically we're not obligated to wear a kippah? Okay? This was a custom. It's actually a very strange custom. It's a custom that came from non-Jews. They were marking us with these funny looking hats so that if we would leave the ghetto they would know who we were. And this became a custom of the Jews. And the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, points out that this minhag, this custom has become so prevalent that it's now called minhag galacha. It's a custom which is so strongly identified with being Jewish that it's as though it's halacha. But it's a stop short of calling it halacha. You're not obligated to do it. But it's so powerful, and the basis for doing this, some of the commentaries, the Pitrei Tshuva says, is because, if I'm not mistaken, is because if the entire Jewish people has accepted it upon themselves, there's a message there. Right? So we call this festival Pesach. This is the name we have taken. You don't see people calling it, you know, Matzah Festival. We call it Pesach. So what is this name? Why is this so intricately bound up? And by the way, if we're right in what we suggested yesterday, that Pesach is the beginning of this whole tapestry of festivals, then this is a very important question. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, Mark. Oh, that's also a very interesting question. Who is actually doing the destruction here? Well, there are two questions actually come out of this verse. First of all, physically speaking, what are we talking about? What's a lintel? What's a doorpost? Whatever. So that's actually not so complicated. The Rambam actually talks about this. There's generally, for example, this has a doorpost, but it doesn't really have a lintel, according to many authorities. Right? Because look how it just spreads into one. Okay, a lintel is there. The sides are called the post, and the top is called the lintel. That's the mashkof, and that's the mezuzah. The mezuzah, by the way, is not actually the thing that we call the mezuzah. Right? Okay? The mezuzah is the post of the door. And we're supposed to put something on the post of the door. And it's very interesting that we call it the post of the door, even though that's not what it is. Okay? But we'll get to that. Right? So that's one issue. The other issue is, and by the way, we painted the whole doorway. But we don't put a mezuzah on the whole doorway. You could have said that there was a mitzvah to put, I don't know, Torah scrolls that line your doorway. We don't do that. We take one particular spot, and that's an interesting question, why? Okay? And the second question is, which is, okay, so God is bringing this plague on the Egyptians, but God doesn't let the mashchit, the destroyer, whatever mashchit means, right? So which is it? And there is an idea, actually, I think the Tzemach Tzedek talks about this, that, that, you know, when you really think about it, there's a problem with suggesting that Hashem does this, because then it means that Hashem doesn't do that. But Hashem does everything. Right? The only question is, how Hashem does everything? So, you know, it could be, what's the difference between Hashem himself doing something and Hashem using something to do something? Right? The mashchit is somehow the vehicle of Hashem's destruction. But that's always the case. So that's a very interesting question. Any other questions? Yes? Oh, very good. It's another question. So, why do we have to be at home? Why can't you walk out on the street? Now, there are lots of different possibilities here. We're not supposed to see the destruction. You know, I guess if God's getting confused between, you know, I don't know, Muhammad and Yehuda Moshe, so if you're out on the street, he won't be able to tell who you are, but if you're in the house, that's ridiculous. So why is it that on this evening, we need to be at home? What is it about the home? By the way, Pesach is a festival which is very much centered around the home. right? For example, the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, which we still, you know, eat symbolically every year, but, you know, when we have a Beit HaMikdash, a temple, hopefully we'll start eating it again, right? You're supposed to eat that in the home. You're supposed to eat that with a chavura, together, right? In one place. You don't bop around, okay? If you look at the Seder has a lot of focus on the family, the four sons and the questions, right? Why is the Seder such a focus of family? Now, it could be, and this is something that speaks to me personally, that this very much relates to what we talked about yesterday. That if part of the message of the Seder, right, or of the festivals in general, is that this is the time when we succeed in becoming one. So where does the beginning of that oneness start? It starts in the family. You know, the most powerful message you can give to someone is that you're part of the family. There's so many Jews today that feel so disenfranchised from Judaism because we haven't succeeded in giving them the message that we're all one family. And anytime we do that, that's a very powerful idea. Right? Okay. By the way, there is an idea that Pesach is ledarot. For example, there's an idea that forever. There's an idea that when Mashiach comes, when redemption comes, there's certain days of sadness that will become days of joy. There's certain festivals which will be removed from the Jewish people. Right? And there's certain festivals which will last forever. Pesach is a festival that lasts forever. Anybody know which festival is the festival that is considered par excellence a temporary festival? No, but very close. Purim. Purim is considered the festival that is most temporary. In fact, when we read on Purim, we read from the Scroll of Esther. Do you ever notice, if you're ever in synagogue when they read the Scroll of Esther, they take it, they unroll it, and they fold it over itself. Why? Because it's supposed to be like an igaret. It's supposed to be like a letter. It's not supposed to be a book. It's supposed to be a letter, which is very temporary. Right? And the whole nature of Purim is very temporary. Where God isn't, you don't find God's name in the Megillah. Right? And in fact, at the end of the day, when you really stop to think about it, Purim, on a certain level, is a failure. Right? Pesach is a success. We get out of Egypt. Shavuot is a success. We get the Torah. Sukkot is a success. We're going to bring in the harvest. But Purim, in Purim, we're still stuck in Persia at the end of Purim. We don't go home. Now, it's true, we're saved. But if freedom is freedom for, we still haven't figured out what freedom for is. So I don't say it's that simple. There are mystical ideas in Purim. But the rabbis suggest that there is a contrast between Purim and Pesach. It's interesting that Purim leads us to Pesach. Because Purim doesn't quite reach the level of Pesach. Right? Yes. But at least on Hanukkah, the difference between Hanukkah and Purim is that Hanukkah, the failure of Hanukkah is not apparent at the end of Hanukkah. It's what we do with the success of Hanukkah. The end of Hanukkah, we did rededicate the temple. We do rediscover the temple, and we do restore royalty to the kingdom of Israel. The problem is we get the wrong kings. That is a detail, right? All right, so let's see if we can make some order out of this. Just maybe to recap, we've got this very strange custom. We have a mezuzah. And the mezuzah seems to stem. Now, by the way, just as an aside, because this also leads us into the realm of mitzvot in general, you know, commandments. We have, when I say we, I mean as a people, by and large, we have allowed ourselves, I think, to some degree, to fall into the rote of ritual. And it strikes me that we are missing something in this world. And we're missing something that I really think Judaism wants us to have. Okay? Mitzvot have become such a routine that we've lost part of the essence of what those mitzvot are about. Now, I don't want you to get me wrong here. Judaism is a religion which believes in deed over creed. In other words, if a mitzvah gives you a particular message, and you find tremendous beauty in that message, right? And you become emotionally involved with the beauty of that message. And it becomes so much a part of you that you don't feel the need to actually fulfill the mitzvah because the idea is so much who you are. Judaism says, nope, doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You know? Judaism does not believe, now by the way, I'm giving you my lens of Judaism, you could definitely beg to differ, but this is how I see what the Torah says, and I think this is what Jewish tradition suggests. Judaism says, it's action that speaks louder than words. You know? Judaism is not ethics espoused. It's ethics demanded. I'll give you, by the way, a great example. And this will lead us into sort of how we look at mitzvot, which will allow us to use Pesach, while we're already at it, as a vehicle for understanding the mitzvah of mezuzah. Because there's nothing more tragic than the fact that we walk in and out of places with a mezuzah and we don't stop to appreciate what an incredible gift it is, what an opportunity for growth it is to walk by a mezuzah.